and welcome to Blind Like Me. And this is kind of a unique thing for me, I'll tell you this. Phil Parr.
Remember him?
My buddy. he has finally worked his way up to 100 shows. And we were back in Houston. I guess it's been about a year ago now, huh?
Yeah.
It was a year ago.
Uh-huh. And we had several people come pull me off to the side and say, hey, on the 100th show, will you interview Phil? Now, I think it's very special because at that time, I don't know what show you were up to. It may have been number 27. I don't know. But I was thinking, well, hell, he'll never get to 100
Never get
shows.
To 100. Never make it to 100 shows.
So I'll never have to do that. But anyway, here we are at number 100, and we are here to talk to Phil Parr, the creator and producer of Blind Like Me and Blind Handyman. And we brought along our comrades, our buddies, who are blind handyman people. Don Patterson is here. And we appreciate him being here.
Light round of applause for Don.
Yeah.
And Don Shaw. Hey.
We all got together for the big 100, didn't we?
It can't be any heavier applause for Don Shaw than me.
Anyway, I'm just proud to be a part of it because Phil's always been a hero of mine and since I met him back in 1973. So we're just going to take it from childhood on. And
are you timing? Is he timing?
We are. We're timing. Here.
What? yeah. Let's start with birth.
Let's start with birth.
Where were you born?
I was born in St. Louis, Missouri.
And?
In 1940.
Okay.
And people are always talking about how much they remember of being a kid. I remember a little about St. Louis, and we moved when I was two. When I was
2 years old.
I was 2 years old. I remember a couple little incidents and scenes in St. Louis. My wife swears that you couldn't remember that. You heard your mother talking about that, and she may be right, but I think I remember something about St. Louis. Born October 12th, 1940 in St. Louis, and I was, these people that we interview all the time are talking about being premature. I was about 2 months early.
Okay.
But that didn't cause my blindness. It had nothing to do with me being blind.
Well, you were totally blind at birth. Is that right?
I was totally blind at birth.
And what was the cause? I'm curious.
It's obviously genetic or hereditary. I mean, if my mother hadn't married my father, it might not have happened. But then they got married, and so it did happen. And I had an older brother, named Wallace, who took his life at age 26. And I have no idea why. I have no idea. You know, you don't know about things like that. But he was also totally blind, and so my parents had some experience with blind children.
Blind. They sure did.
So you were. Yeah. He was 26 when he took his life.
He was 26 when he took his life. So he was.
How did that make you feel? I mean, what kind of impact did that have on you at the time?
It did the same thing as it does now. I didn't understand it then. I don't understand it now. He was so bright and so, well, he was my hero. I mean, he was everything I wanted to be and knew I never would be. He was he was interested in radio. He got me interested in radio. You know, I always tell the joke about my brother. He's wonderful. He taught me how to smoke and drink. A couple of things.
Yeah, he was enough older. He would have been at the age at that time.
Yeah. He took me, the year before he died, we went to, Wallace was in Corpus when he died. And so we went down to Corpus and spent Easter with he and I and a couple other, a guy named Carl West. And we played music all weekend and smoked and drank all weekend. It was the greatest, most fun I'd ever had in my life. This is what I want to do. And but my brother, did what, John?
And you were how old at that time when you
was
the Corpus
well, I was,
trip?
I was this is a Corpus trip. I guess I was 15.
15.
Yeah, because he turned 26 the 29th of September, and I turned 16 on the 12th of October, and Christmas, he took his life at Christmas, right, the Christmas Eve.
So he was, what, 26? And
he was 26, 15. And I was 16. We had just turned 16.
Okay. So you're just at the right age to start drinking and smoking.
And exactly what I did. And while Wallace played the ukulele, and he played all kinds of crazy chords. Back then, ukuleles were kind of a neat instrument. Remember Arthur Godfrey that played the ukulele?
Oh,
and
yes,
it was kind of a neat little instrument to play, and so he could really shuck and jive chords on that uke and sang all kinds of little tunes, and he knew radio. I mean, you could just ask him about, about this radio station or that one, and he just gave me, the night before I went back to the blind school, when I was 15 years old, we stayed up all night long and talked radio.
Boy.
Because that's what I loved.
So Wally had a big influence on your life.
Oh, man.
So did the guy do radio? Was he working in radio?
He had a degree from the University of Texas in communications.
Really?
That he got long before there were computers and long before there were any.
Boy, that would have been a...
So he had to read, when he was doing a commercial, he had to read the Braille, didn't he?
He read Braille. He did a little show on Kite, KITE, 930 San Antonio, on Saturdays from 2 to 3 or 2 to 7 or 2 to 4. I think it's a couple hours, maybe 3 hours, 2 to 5 on Saturday afternoon. He would come home from college on Friday nights, and they would, I guess, bring him a tape of these commercials, and this secretary, I never will forget, her name was Ruth Schenkel. She would read these commercials on this tape, and as fast as she'd read them, Wallace would type them on his Braille writer.
Yeah.
Now, Ruth couldn't read. Ruth read about like Blanche Jones would read a commercial. Okay?
Okay.
I love Blanche Jones, but she couldn't read a commercial. And she knows that. I wish she was here. Anyway, as fast as she could read these commercials, well, he'd type them just as, on his Braille writer, and then the next day he would deliver these commercials. He would read them in Braille. Occasionally, you could hear his hand.
Yeah.
You'd hear his hand sliding across the Braille page, but he could read Braille fast. He used to read the Bible to my mother in Braille.
So your parents had two blind children.
Yep.
Out of three, if I remember correct.
Have a sister
named Marcia.
Yeah, it's 66.
Who is sighted.
Who is absolutely perfectly sighted. Who's
okay. Well,
a beautiful girl.
Tell me this, if you would.
What?
Your parents.
Yes.
How would you grade your parents on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the best, as far as being parents of two blind children?
Were they the kind of parents that let you do, you guys have discussed this a lot before, the parents that won't let their children do anything, and then you got the parents on the other hand that will let their children do everything. So, yeah, how would they?
If you graded them on that, you'd have to say they let me do anything I wanted to do when I was a kid. I remember riding a tricycle, had a wagon. I walked to the store. I did anything I wanted to when I was a kid. Anything I wanted to. When I got up in the morning, I left and I came home when it's supper time.
You say that's the way to.
All day long, I was playing with Bunny Jean and Billy Boy, the Devers kids down the street, Tommy Goggin, Lou Allen. I played with those kids all day long. We rode tricycles. We rode scooters up and down the street. We did anything we wanted to do. Those kids treated me.
So you're just one of the.
Yeah, I was just kind of one of the. I mean, I knew I was blind and I wasn't.
Yeah,
like
sure.
Them, but now my mother couldn't see me all the time, and we went everywhere. We had this old lady next door that stood named Miss Taylor. We'd go see her every day and sit and talk to her a while, listen to her soap operas. I got interested this lady that lived next door to us. This lady lived next door to us named Miss Hines. Miss Hines loved me when I was a kid. She took care of me. I mean, she talked to me all the time, and I guess she didn't think we had enough food to eat, because she'd bring, we had plenty of food. People are.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Food. She'd make potato salad.
Yeah. Little Phil needs a cake. I've made him a cake. God love his heart. She'd bring me things. And one day I was out playing in the water hose. Kids, you remember when you was a kid, you'd play in.
Oh, yeah.
You didn't have a swimming
pool. No swimming pool.
Number three tub that we would jump in with the water hose. We'd have a number three tub with our butt sticking down in the tub and our legs hanging out and our head hanging hanging out.
Really?
And spray each other.
Playing with a water hose.
Yeah. Oh, it was fun on the hot summertime.
Sure it was. It's what kids did back in the 40s and 50s.
Yeah, no Nintendo, no computer.
What, nothing else.
Anyway, I was out playing with the water hose, and Miss Hine got her water hose without me knowing it and squirted me, and I turned around and nailed her. Straight on.
Man.
Her with her dress on and everything. I hit her straight square on. She thought it was the funniest thing that ever. She laughed and laughed and laughed. She just thought that was hilarious. And she loved me. She was good to me.
I had a question that I thought about a long time. I woke up in the middle of the night, and I thought about me, since I had polio when I was young.
Yeah.
I thought about you being born totally blind.
Yeah.
When did you realize you were blind? As a child,
I grew up not
knowing I was crippled.
I really have no idea. I knew I was blind, but the blindness didn't affect me till they sent me to school. I mean, it really didn't bother me till I was with sighted kids all the time. They knew I was blind. They took care of me. We fought. We jumped. We ran. We did everything. The blindness didn't start bothering me, or it didn't really dawn on me till I went to the blind school. Till they sent me off to the. But I haven't just to say when you realized
that part just wasn't a big deal at that time, was it?
It wasn't a big deal to me.
That's kind of my story.
Was there some moment when you realized?
But I was almost grown when that happened. And my goodness, I didn't know. Hell, I had like six brothers and sisters.
Yeah.
And I was treated just like everybody else. I mean, I couldn't pedal the bike, but I could coast it down the hill, you know. I didn't realize I was crippled. In fact, my father-in-law paid me the greatest compliment that has ever been paid to anybody, as far as I know.
Yeah.
I went up, and I was marrying his daughter, and I went up and spent some time there, about 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
And his comment about me, not to my face, but behind my back, and I was later told, is that SOB is crippled and he don't even know it.
Because at that time, you were walking up and down stairs.
Well, yeah, I was on my crutches, of course.
Yeah.
But I mean, I just didn't think of it as being crippled, because I had brothers that hit me in the nose as quick as they would anybody.
Yeah, we'd have to tell. There was a point in time when you did the dive ball lumberjack ball game for me.
Oh, yeah.
At the radio station.
We climbed the stage.
And you climbed the bleachers with your crutches.
Those were the good old days.
I mean, you just climb right up the bleacher steps on your crutches.
Now I'd have to roll up in it.
Folks, we'd have to get a hoist. Some sort of a block and tackle. He wouldn't last to climb it up there. I had two cripple guys work for me at the radio station. When I was running the radio station down by, I had two cripple guys. I had Tom and Admiral Lester. And both, we'd send them out to do the ball games. And they were, you know, I know that people thought, why would they send those cripple guys out to do the ball games? You know.
Yeah,
they thought that.
Kind of the handicap express.
Uh-huh. Well, we want to talk to you a little bit about your radio experience a little bit later. Right now, let's take a break, if you don't mind. We'll take a little break
here. Time?
And then we come back. We want to go to the blind school in Austin, Texas.
Let's go to the blind school in Austin, Texas.
Okay. Thank you.
And I have made a lot of new friends on the Blind Like Me list that I'll never forget.
Well, them crazy people on that Blind Like Me list just talk about the silliest thing.
To join the Blind Like Me list, send a blank email to blindlikeme-subscribe@yahoogroups.com. That's blindlikeme-subscribe@yahoogroups.com.
Okay, I love being on the Blind Like Me list because I'm the moderator, and I get to delete people if I want to.
If you enjoy chatting with other blind folks, come join us on the Blind Like Me list. Send a blank email to blindlikeme-subscribe@yahoogroups.com.
Yeah.
Everybody say what? It's years since you've been there. And now you've disappeared somewhere, like out of space. Someone or became aware of a person or whatever. Let's try the day after Labor Day, 1948.
Was that your day?
1948.
Was that your day?
That's my day.
Yeah.
That was my day.
That's when it dawned on that you were...
No, that's when they shipped me off. And the only reason I said the day after Labor Day, that's usually when school started in Texas.
That's true. It did forever.
Yeah. And lo and behold, I appeared at the Texas School for the Blind, and somewhere among the students was one Philip Parr.
Yes, sir. We were there.
And you know, I've known him. I'm 63 years old, so I was six at that time. Actually, five.
Yeah.
Going to be six.
In September.
And I've known him all these years. We kind of grooved together for a while. Then there was about a 20 or so year span that we didn't speak to each other. It was nothing to do with personalities. We were just out of touch. I mean, we weren't...
Well, our paths didn't cross. You were doing one thing and I was doing something else, you know. But our lives have been... We've been friends. We became friends shortly after you came. And we've been friends since 1948.
That's amazing. Yeah, that's just... Yeah. What a deal.
Spent a lot of time as adults together.
That's one of the reasons also we wanted to bring Don Pat and Don Shaw in on the interview here is that Don Patterson has known you almost all your life. I mean, my
He's known me a long
gracious.
Time.
And I've known you since about 1973.
Yeah.
And as you know someone, I would say this in a tribute or talking about Phil's life at 65 years old. He's the only person I've ever known that knew what he wanted to do when he grew up.
I've heard you say that.
Yeah, and I have, and I say it today, and he's the only person. He knew what he was going to be, and he loved radio. That's all. At one time, the count was 400 and something stations. He knew he could list them off. He could tell you if they were a sundown station or a clear channel station.
That impressed me.
Call letters, the location, and probably their number one DJ. You know, and so.
You mean the information's not important?
Unbelievable.
I can't believe it. You don't think that's important.
I thought it was great.
Call out a frequency, and he could just give you the owner of the radio station.
What do you mean?
Yeah, for a radio
could.
Person.
Well, I don't understand this. What do you mean?
I mean, wait a minute. He can. He still can, folks.
But
I guarantee you.
It really made an impression on me. And also, briefly, earlier he had talked about his brother.
Yeah, you knew Wallace.
I knew, and also... I knew when Wallace took his life, and I was kind of there for some events in Phil's life. I was very close to his mother and dad. I've been to their home. Phil lived in San Antonio for several years.
Until 55.
Yeah, and then they moved to Houston. And it's really strange. We sort of had a kind of a talking relationship in between school years. And one time after I was grown, at midnight, my phone rang.
Once.
And so I had to go look up a phone number, but I called it back. And Phil Parr answered the phone.
Because you knew who it was.
And as it turned out, that had been our signal for years. If we wanted to talk in the summertime, during the school year,
do the
phone,
one ringer? The
phone
one ring.
Would ring once at midnight, and you knew who it was.
That would keep you from waking your parents up, because I could call his phone. If my phone rang once anytime late, I knew it was him, and I'd call him back. That way my parents didn't get awakened, and I could do the same thing to him. That way we'd spend lots of times talking. Yeah, I don't know what the hell we talked about.
Three or four? I don't either.
What
girl was it? I wonder.
I have no idea.
But at the school, I mean, I knew the radio and also the music came out. Tell us about the time, or I'd like to ask you about the time when you decided you wanted to play bass. I want you to tell us about getting the big bass fiddle.
Well, they weren't. Of course, they were. They didn't. Blind school was very restrictive. I mean, they weren't very. They didn't like me, and I didn't like them. We got off to a very bad start.
Yeah,
we got off to a very, very bad start. I went there in 1946. Just to give you a little history, and it was a total. Of course, I'm sure it was for you. I know it was for you, Pat, also. But it was a complete turn upside down in my world. I was with this old woman that didn't like me and didn't like anybody and didn't like herself, and 27 other blind kids that I did not understand at all. And I never got comfortable there. I never got past that. Anyway, the bass incident, I wanted to learn to play bass. I was rooming with Tomas Alvidres or Bill Nungaster or somebody, and they wanted to learn. I'd seen this upright bass around, and they kind of showed me how to tune it. So I went and I was sneaking it out on weekends. I'd go over there on Friday afternoons. I'd go to the band hall, and just very blatantly, I'd walk right down the middle hall of the main building, right to the band room, pick up the bass, walk out with it, walk down the library steps, carrying it to there. I figured out a way to carry a little bass carry that you could do, and I'd carry it to the cottage, and we'd have the upright bass all weekend. And then Monday morning, when they opened the main building early, because they'd get there at 7:30, 7:45, open the main building, I would reverse the process and take it back and put it right back where it went. And I did this for months. And we played dances with it. We had the bass. Well, then one day, the bass was standing in a corner, and somebody came in and slammed the door, and the bass fell over forward and broke the fingerboard off and snapped the bridge.
Oh, man.
And I wasn't supposed to have the damn bass in the first place.
And several people were interested in your well-being.
I was 15 years old or 16 when I was dying. I think that's the year they finally expelled me that year. We moved to Houston in 55.
You didn't graduate that soon.
And I turned 55. In 55, we moved to Houston. And in 56, they expelled me in the spring of 56. So I was 15 years old.
Which would have been around the same year that you guys went to Corpus.
This was the Easter party in Corpus was during that year, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
Was during that year. Shortly after I got back from the Easter party in Corpus, the bass fell over.
Man.
So that was a bad year.
What a year.
It was a hell of a year for me. And I was trying to learn to play music and trying to learn to do something. I couldn't do anything. I couldn't read Braille. I couldn't do anything. And so this bass fell over, and it wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. I thought it was really going to be bad. The good enoughs were there, and Miss Goodenough, I don't think they ever punished me even for doing it. I mean, I don't know that it was that they punished me. I was in trouble for all kinds of things then. They had a new guy named Mr. Hill. He was Robert Hill. He was a social director. And I was on. That was a bad year. They ended up. That's the year I walked in the study hall smoking a cigarette.
So out of
I was just in trouble. I mean, I was in bad trouble. My grades sucked.
You're just ready
as they always did. And it was time for me to leave, and so I just walked in study hall one night smoking a cigarette.
You figured that would just go ahead and get you a trip out.
It did. It worked.
Yeah,
it worked like
it
a top.
It worked good.
Let me ask you this.
They shipped me away real quick.
What in the world, what caused you to want to play the bass? I mean,
I just liked the way it sounded. I just liked the way an upright bass sounded.
And that was it. It sounded good, so here we go.
It seemed like something I could do, I think, and I'm pretty sure I was room with Tomas and somebody else in that corner room in Cottage F, the room by the kitchen.
Yeah.
And on that end, by the kitchen end,
you know exactly what you're talking about.
And it was kind of winter time, and they were teaching, and Tomas was teaching me to play upright bass, and he played mandolin and fiddle, and we were singing, "I don't believe you've met my babe." They were singing in country tunes. And I thought, man, this is great.
Yeah.
And then it fell over. And, of course, then they wouldn't let me have it anymore. They bought a new one. Bought a little blonde K bass, that's nice amazing. Bass. And they wouldn't let me have it anymore. I couldn't sneak it out for it. That didn't last long. Of course, they expelled me that spring. And I was 15. And I had my eyes removed that summer. My eyes were bad looking. They looked bad, and so cosmetically, and they never would have worked. So they removed my eyes that summer. Of course, I'd failed now the eighth grade six or eight times. And it was...
It was just time to move on.
Oh, it was late. Well, I went back, and I think I was in the eighth grade again. I was in, but I always got to meet new kids. It's like Ronald Reagan said when he had Alzheimer's. He said, "Well, the wonderful thing about it is I get to meet new people every day."
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
The great thing was, I got a new bunch of kids every year. I got new kids.
Well, that's
loved
true.
Because I was the old man. I was. He knows what's going on. He's
yeah.
Speaking of Brian. Yeah. School. Okay, let's stay with the blind school just a minute.
All right, let's do that.
One of the favorite stories that I have from you, from the blind school, was the day that you and all the other guys drove the car. And
that wasn't a blind school story. That was long after the blind school.
Oh, it was? I was thinking it was during the blind school.
No, that was long after. That was 61.
Oh.
That was long. That was a blind school. We had long since gotten out of there. But the blind school and I didn't do well. They didn't like me, and I didn't like them. So in 58, I was always in trouble. First of all, I can't read Braille. I couldn't read Braille. I don't know if I am Braille challenged, but it's not something I want to do and can't. It's something I can't do. I cannot read Braille. When I slide my hand back to the first of the line, I have no idea where I am. It just looks like a bunch of mumbo jumbo. I can't do it. I mean, if you put the lines, if you skip the line between each line, I could read Braille. But I get lost. I can't get past that. And if you can't read Braille, then you can't do your homework.
I don't think it's something they're going to hold against you at this point. You know, my point starting out was the fact that you knew what you wanted to be. I would say at 10 or 12, I mean, and
at least.
I told Thomas Houston that I'm the only person I've ever met that knew. And so we can get beyond the blind school and the fact that you don't read Braille, and we won't hold it against you.
But the music came first, before the radio, before the first radio job.
What I was trying to explain was why I was such a misfit there, why they didn't like me.
Yeah.
Why I
can't. Exactly.
And so that's all past and all long gone.
Well, no, I think we were all, in some respects, I was a misfit there.
It was a tough school. Let me say this. It was a tough
You
place.
Were incarcerated for no crime that you had committed, you know, but you were treated as a prisoner.
My wife finds it unconscionable that there would be times that they had what they called a party every 2 weeks when we were in high. We're kind of in high school. Only did when you're in high school. Well, they had one every 2 weeks. They have a party every 2 weeks. And the week they didn't have a party, from Friday afternoon until Monday morning, there was nothing to do.
Period.
There was no activity. You could go to, if it was girl, if it was, do I need to turn your mic off?
No.
If it was girls' town day, then you didn't get to go to town. You didn't get to do anything.
Because the girls were there.
The girls got to go to town. And the boys couldn't go to town when the girls were in town. And so there'd be, you know, from Friday afternoon, you'd have nothing to do till Monday morning. And then you'd have something you didn't want to do, which was go to back to school. That's having an asthma.
So when you left school, get away from school a little bit.
Yeah.
What did you do immediately after school? I mean, what exactly did you do?
You mean when I...
Here's a blind guy. He's out of school.
You mean when I left the blind school?
Yes, sir.
Well, I quit him in 58. In 58... they begged me to stay.
Like he had a choice.
They roll out the red carpet.
Wait a minute. I had a choice until wait a minute. Hang on. I think I had a choice. They finally sent a letter and expelled me again. Asked me not to come back. We think it would be best if Phil didn't return to our institution. I think is the way they put it. And I thought it was best. But I'd already told them. They all knew I wasn't coming back. I had made it abundantly clear.
Yeah. What did you do? Go back.
So
you went back home?
They took the opportunity to pile on.
That's exactly right. They took the opportunity
to
expel me. I will. Those people can, you know. Anyway, let's don't get into it. I was very bitter and still am in a lot of ways. It affected me. I had blind school dreams for 20 years after it was a horrible. I considered jumping out of the third floor main building window at 16. I did. It was horrible. It was terrible. If this is as good as it gets, I ain't interested, folks.
What did you do? Did you go back home?
I went home.
Yes, sir.
I went home and sat around. This was 58, the spring of 58. I was going to be 18 in October, and I told my parents I wasn't going back. My daddy threw a fit, just went nuts. He just couldn't understand why I wouldn't go back to W.E. Allen's wonderful Texas School for the Blind and get educated. And in retrospect, the only thing they had taught me that would possibly make me a living was how to tune a piano, and they did that. They taught me how to tune pianos. But I just really couldn't see myself. A lot of people make a living at piano tuning, and I guess I could have too. And I could tune a piano at that time, and I guess I still can.
Yeah.
But I knew all about pianos. I knew exactly how they worked. I knew what an action looked like. I knew how to take one apart. The only thing I needed was to get faster at piano tuning and piano repair.
Okay.
And that wasn't really what I wanted to do. And I couldn't see them teaching me anything else I could use. You know, I wasn't to be an English professor. That was pretty obvious.
Yeah.
I'd say so.
Yeah. You know, that wasn't going to happen. So so I left in 58, and I went home, and I sat around for through September and October and November. I went back and visited the blind school in October on my birthday. And November, December, January came an old boy named Patterson's gone. An old boy named Russell Stevens had quit the same year I did, called me and said, "Hey, I'm selling brooms door to door out here at the Lighthouse for the Blind in Houston. They'd give you a job if you wanted one. I've already talked to them. You got a job if you want it." And I said, "Oh, you mean they'd really hire me?" So I didn't know what I was going to do. I tuned a few church pianos that summer. The old Park Memorial Baptist Church. I tuned those pianos and bummed around and made a few potholders and sold them. And so he said, and it's January. He said they'd hire you as a salesman on this broom cruise. So I went out to the Lighthouse for the Blind and met them out there that morning. And they trained me to sell brooms door to door.
You just said, "What the hell? I'm not doing anything anyway. Might as well do that."
Well, I was doing less than anything. My mother had me down to two packs of cigarettes a week, folks. That's less than seven cigarettes a day.
So it was time to move on.
It was time to do something. I needed to get away from my parents.
Do something.
But I had no plan, no idea, no thought, nothing. Yeah. I had no concept. I just knew that if the blind school was all there was, I wasn't going back anymore. I'd had enough of their BS.
Yeah.
So, you know, I sat around and went to work for the broom crew.
Yeah.
I sold brooms door to door, and I thought this was wonderful. This was great because I had money. And they'd kind of take me, let's see, I'd catch the canal bus and change to the Taft 6000 bus and ride out to the lighthouse on West Allis every morning. You've been out there.
Yeah.
On West Allis. And they'd meet the sales crew out there.
And they would take you to sell these brooms? They would take the crew to a neighborhood?
Out to a neighborhood, and we would get out, and they'd put us out on a street, and we'd walk along that street, and we'd sell some brooms and mops and potholders and lint brushes and dish rags. And
kind of like we used to do with magazines.
Exactly, the same thing.
Just go down the street and cross over and come back.
That's back in the days when people were at home. Women didn't work a lot, and people were at home.
Oh, there were lots of people
at home.
Would answer the door, and if I'd had sense enough, I could have sold a lot. And I sold my share.
Yeah.
I sold quite a few. But about June, sometime in June, a really weird thing happened. The old boy that ran the broom crew, his name was Tommy Wright from Carthage, Texas. Tommy Wright had drank up all the crew money and didn't have any more money, and there was no more sales crew. Doug McGill had a sales crew. There were two sales crews operating out of the lighthouse. Doug McGill's and Tommy Wright's. And Tommy Wright's crew didn't have a driver and didn't have a truck and didn't have anything. It kind of folded up.
Well, yeah.
So I went to my parents and got them to buy me a $200 International 1946 International panel truck from the Nabisco. My daddy worked for Nabisco. They bought me this old panel truck, and I, after working there 6 months, was the head of the crew.
Hey.
I was running the broom crew. You came and worked for me.
Yeah.
Didn't you?
I did.
Don Pat came and worked for me.
In the summer between my junior and senior year in high school.
Yeah.
And I was a very good salesman, I must say.
Is that right?
I did well.
What do you do when you go to the door with a broom to say? What do you say?
Well, you have a whole bunch of things.
Oh, no. Hello, I'm Phil Parr with the Lighthouse Houston.
But this is his interview, yeah. You have a whole bunch of stuff to sell.
Okay.
Not just a broom.
It wasn't just a broom.
No, you had brooms and rayon mops and dust mops.
Oh, okay.
You had cellulose mops. You had a push broom. You put all these together with a big rubber band, big tire.
And you carried this whole bundle of things with you.
Oh, yeah, and the people did have a choice. That's
and
good.
You tried to look pitiful.
Guide dog or cane.
You wear your dark glasses.
Dark glasses.
I did not wear dark glasses.
You never have. That's one thing I've noticed.
Well, I wore them when I worked the workshops. I wore dark glasses a lot.
Okay.
But we sold brooms. Don went to work for us. We old Charles Alexander, who went to the blind school with us and got a driver's license. He was driving the truck. I had not one crew. I had two crews at one time.
And the guy from the blind school drove the truck.
In town crew and the out of town crew.
Did I not?
Yeah.
Did I not? I was entrepreneur Phil.
I think I was traversing between the two crews.
How long did that last, Phil? When was that over?
That lasted until about the middle of October of that same year. And I hired this girl. And I hired Larry Liggins' wife. Her name was Mary.
Mary, I'm always thinking about you.
And Mary and I ran off to Corpus with all the money and burdens.
They ran off. They just lit out.
What did you do in Corpus?
I mean, sold brooms.
Oh, sold brooms in Corpus.
Well, I took my truck and my load of brooms and said, "Dale, with you guys and me and Mary."
Now, what year would this be?
This was 1959.
That didn't last about 2 weeks.
That didn't last but about 4 months.
4 months.
That lasted about 4 months. Right after Christmas, by shortly after New Year's, 1960, I was home.
Oh, okay.
Same problem again. No job, no nothing to do. Of course, I sold brooms, and so I knew some people, so I found me a broom job. What? Now what? What did I do? What did I do?
No, I was just saying, you sew brooms?
I found another broom crew to go to work for, and I went to work for old George Wright, who worked out of town. And we went up to Nacogdoches and sold, and over to Beaumont, and over to Carthage, and here and there, and we sold everywhere, and we ran around, me and this friend of mine named Henry Gonzalez. And, of course, Henry, you'd have to know Henry to know Henry. You knew Henry. Henry was totally blind, and Henry beat hell out of the driver one night, and they fired both of us. But anyway, neither here nor there.
Man,
it was a rough life. You know? So I'd selling brooms door to door, and then I went to Austin and spent a summer in Austin. It's 1960 passed, and I worked broom crews, and I spent a summer in 1960, and we worked. And Tommy Wright and I went up to Austin. Tommy was the original broom crew guy at the lighthouse. We went up there, and Miss Weber at the lighthouse arrested me for selling brooms in her town.
Yeah.
Put me in jail.
Weber,
this was late 19.
Name.
This was Christmas. Yeah, you remember her?
Yeah, well, mean, sort of. Yeah,
mean old woman. I think she's dead now. Anyway, she put me in jail for selling brooms in her town. So we hitchhiked and da da da. 61. Here came 1961. And 61. I spent the summer of 61 in Austin with John and Joe Helen. I went back to Houston in 1961. And now we get to what my life made a major turnaround at that time. Can we take a break now?
We're talking about a break right now. Then we're going to come back and talk about radio, I would
think. We're going to talk about radio. And my life up until then had no plan. It still had no plan. But it got a whole lot better after 1961.
Yeah, stay tuned.
Yeah.
Stay tuned
back
for the rest of the story. A trip to Walmart.
I wonder where the pharmacy is. It's somewhere over here. Oh, God, I've got my cane caught in something.
Pardon me, sir. I don't know how to tell you this, but the end of your cane is stuck in my...
Why bother shopping the big discount stores when you can shop from the comfort of your own home at BlindMySmart.com?
Hi, this is Dale Campbell, president of Blind My Smart. If you can't find what you're looking for today, check back tomorrow. We're adding new products every day.
Blind My Smart, with thousands of products at a completely accessible website. Our address is BlindMySmart.com. Again, that's www.blindmysmart.com.
Okay, here we are. We're back with more Blind Like Me, and my name's Tom Houston. Don Patterson, Don Shaw is here. And we're talking, of course, to Phil Parr, the creator and producer of Blind Like Me and Blind Handyman Show. And I mentioned earlier, Phil, we were talking about the blind guys driving the car.
Yeah, driving the car.
And, of course, I had my dates switched around a little bit.
Yeah, you
but
thought
will
that
you
was,
tell us that story?
You thought that was blind school time. This was long after mine, because I was living in a little apartment on Lenox Avenue or in Houston, and this guy named Charles Alexander and John Bennett. John Bennett was there just before John got married. John Bennett was there, and Charles Alexander, and Henry Gonzalez, the famous Henry. We talked about Henry a while ago. Henry's the guy that beat hell out of the driver.
Yeah, the driver of the...
Got inspired. We were still running around with Henry. Anyway, we were all drinking wine, and Charles could see real well. Charles had gotten a driver's license. Charles could always see better than most of us. He couldn't see better than Donald Pat, but he'd gotten a driver's license.
A guy that went to the blind school and then
but he was legally blind, right?
Well, kind of legally
blind. One of those borderline iffy.
Oh, okay.
He'd fooled around, fudged around, and got himself. Yeah. He drove the broom crew for a while. He had an old Jeep, and he'd drive us around. Anyway, crazy Charles. Anyway, he had this Ford Falcon. He's a brand new Ford Falcon. It actually belonged to Nolan Harrison. It belonged to his stepdad. And so he'd come over in that Ford Falcon. So we decided that I don't know what we were going to do. We were going to drive the car. I don't know what we were going to do, but I drove Henry drove and John Bennett ran the car into a parked car and a fence.
Oh,
and John
man.
Could see, Henry and I are both totals.
John could see pretty good.
John could see as good as Charles. Henry's a total, I'm a total. John Bennett ran the car. Maybe he won't hear this, man. Poor John.
Sure,
anyway,
he won't be listening.
He ran again, and so the cops came out, and they fooled around. They talked to us a while. They took my fold-up beer opener away from me, and they, which was very important. It really hacked me.
Well, yeah.
What a big hard day and time, I guess.
And we fooled around, and they finally said, well, y'all need to go home.
No pop-tops.
No pop-top can. Y'all figure out a way. A record driver will take you home, boy. And so the record driver took me home.
Really?
And I met this cop. His name was Laird, Officer Laird. I met him years ago, years after that, in a club where I was playing. And I asked him, he remembered me and I remembered him, man, what was the deal there? Why didn't you take us downtown? He said, hell, they wouldn't have believed it. They'd have made fun of me. They'd have laughed at me. You brought four blind guys in who wrecked a car. You're nuts. He said, they never would have let me forget it. And, and I guess he's right. But anyway, that's a true, absolutely true, silly story that happened to us.
So John Bennett, they could see good, was just tooling down the street. I'm just driving right along.
And just smacked into a parked car.
I can almost visualize that.
Of course, he's taking only partial credit for it.
Amazing.
Anyway.
That is just wild.
Your first radio job.
Anyway, it's 1960. Watch, it's 1960. Well, let me tell you one story before I tell you the radio
job. Okay, go ahead.
1960, end of 1961, fixing to be 1962. I was at John and Joe Helen's in Austin, and I looked out. On the back porch, there was a guy. There was a big amplifier and a big four-stringed instrument in a case. It was an electric bass and an amplifier, and it was the first one I had ever seen in my life. Why is this here? This guy is hiding it here because he owes money on it. I called the guy. He said, if you'll pay for it, you can have it. I went down to J.R. Reed Music Company and paid up his balance and took it home to Houston with me and taught myself to play it. This was 1962.
And you did that because
I was tired of selling brooms, and I knew that something surely I could do. And so I taught myself to play this electric bass, and it was right at the end of February, this girl I knew called and said, the drummer didn't show up. Could you come and play bass for us? We need a third instrument. I went to this club called the Zanzibar on Canal Street in Houston. I played Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. And Saturday night, at the end of the night, the guy paid us and said, get rid of the two guys who are playing with you. Get yourself a band. You're the best thing we've ever had. Because I knew 2,000 country songs and I could sing. I knew songs I didn't realize I knew. I mean, I knew, anything they requested that had been recorded, I knew it. I didn't realize I knew all those songs, but I was playing bass, and that's began that. By the end of 1962, I was married to Polly Marie, my first wife.
Mm-hmm.
Another fortuitous thing happened to me in 1962. I was playing at a little club in September called the Blue Angel. I had a little old band together. The guy called me Saturday morning and said, how attached are you to the guitar player you have? And I said, well, I know him real well. His name was J.L. Munson. You remember him, Pat? Anyway, he said, well, I got a guitar player I want you to hire. I want to keep you and the drummer, but I want to get rid of the guitar player and hire this guitar player. This guitar player was named Herbie Treese. Herbie Treese was the guitar player on the Utah Carl television show, and by 1963, I was married and on the Utah Carl television show.
I kind of had that in my notes, the Utah Carl deal.
It just all happened. I mean, I had no plan. I had no...
You fell into it.
1963, we had George was born in no plan, no idea what the hell was going on.
I remember Herbie.
Herbie Treese was a fine guitar player. He wasn't Brian quality or Randy quality, but he was a pretty good old guitar player. He wrote a lot of songs. Back then, country music was different.
Yeah.
1963, George came along in June. In August, I went to the radio station in Texas City and made them a deal to buy 2 hours a day, a week, for $25 an hour, $50 a week. And I would sell advertisers and pay for the time. And the honest to God truth is I got so in debt to them, the only way to get their money back was to hire me, which they did.
But it worked out.
The spring of 1964. But they didn't really have anybody. I was a radio man. They didn't really have anybody that knew radio. In late 64, the old boy that was running the radio station was doing less than a sterling job.
Yeah. Yeah.
There were a lot of those.
And guess who came along?
Oh.
Bill LeGrand. Along came Bill LeGrand. And the rest is history. And I worked there.
Now, this was
and ever.
What, Texas City?
This was KETLW 920 in Texas City.
Okay, but now you also worked a little while. I don't know if it was weekends or what, but you were at Kix for a while.
I worked weekend at Kix in Houston, which was the number one radio station. However, this was on Kix FM. We didn't realize what a tremendous audience the FM station had.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
everybody,
that.
You know, everybody was AM. AM was this.
Focused AM. On AM. At
oh, everybody's focused on AM at the time. But I worked at Kix FM. Worked weekends. Worked noon to six, Saturday and Sunday at Kix FM, and could have hung around and probably gotten a full time job there. But I didn't. I got off to a bad start there. Kind of like wasn't as bad as a blind school. But Bill Bader didn't like me. He didn't like me because I could tell you why he didn't like me, but I would really sound. He didn't like me.
You just don't leave it at that.
He didn't like me because I was. He didn't like me because I knew more about radio than he did, yeah. And he knew it.
But he got to be a constable.
But he got to be a constable, and I didn't.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you.
I never wanted to be a constable. Did you?
I know, but I thought maybe y'all were in competition.
You were at KTLW, Texas City. You were at Kix in Houston.
And Kix in Houston.
That's the fourth largest city in the country.
Yeah.
Why did you move to East Texas?
Yeah, that would have been...
I had played all the clubs. I was 30. I decided this at 30, which was 1970.
Yeah.
I decided at 30 that I would make this move. And it was time to do something. I'd played all the clubs in town. I'd worked this television show. Utah Carl was really never did like me, and he didn't like me because I got more mail than he did, and that's the truth. I got a lot more fan mail than he did, and he didn't like me. And he was about ready to fire me from the TV show, and eventually did. Fired me from the TV show.
Of course, I can remember you saying, I've been fired from every job I've ever had.
Of course, the TV show folded 6 months after he left. Because I wasn't the star of the TV show, but I was very popular on that TV show. I was on that TV show from 63 to 70 in Houston. And it was time for me to go do something else. It was time. I'd run the club that I was started in 64 at the Western Club, and I'd run it pretty well. We'd had ups and downs, and we were doing all right, but it was time for me to do something. And my first wife was from up here. I slay up here, up here in East Texas.
up here.
And so we decided we'd move to East Texas and start over. And it was a good thing.
Did you have any connection to East Texas, or you just said, "Hey, I'm going to East Texas."
"Hey, I'm going to East Texas." And 15 days after I went up here, a guy named David Stallings hired me at KSBL.
Answer this, if you would. When you were coming up Highway 59, coming out of Houston, did you stop anywhere else?
Well, no, because she was from here.
Oh,
okay. I'd already bought a house here. I bought a house in Lufkin. I bought a house in Huntington, actually in whatever would be between Lufkin and Huntington, which would be what?
Burke.
No, that's...
You're
talking about 69.
You're going down 69, then you're going to pick up 69 south and go to Huntington.
69. 69, between Lufkin and Hutch, out at Ball Hill.
And David Stallings was doing what?
Yeah, he was the manager. Oh.
David Stallings was the manager of the radio station at that point.
And he hired you as?
As a disc jockey.
Okay, he hired you as a disc jockey. So you went in there, jockey. You had an audition tape.
Well, no, I really didn't have an audition tape.
You did not?
No, I was working. I had the first night I moved up here, I worked the Nature's Club down on Highway 94.
Yes, sir.
Who was that, him?
That was John.
John.
Oh. The first night I lived here, I worked the Nature's Club out on Highway 94. And so they wanted me to do radio. So I did a commercial for the Nature's Club. Mm-hmm. And David Stallings called everybody in the office and said, this is the way we ought to do production. And when I heard about that, I went to him and said, well, hey, how'd you like to have the guy that did that?
Yeah.
I hire that guy.
That makes
there
sense.
You go.
And so he asked me, how would you know what song you were going to play next? And I said, well, I'll tell you what you do. You set the needle down on a song and play 3 seconds of it, and I'll tell you what it is. And he did about 10 songs and hired me.
Very good. That's nice. That's a good testimony.
He did about 10 songs and hired me. So I went to work there and playing a little music and on the side. And, 3 months after I was up here, I was back in gear.
So you were going again.
I was working radio and playing at night. I was doing the same thing up here. I was doing
Houston.
Down there. Except it was in a lot smaller environment. We didn't have near the traffic or, you know, we didn't have near the cost of living.
Yeah.
We bought a little house in Huntington. And, you know, they didn't have anybody knew anything about radio.
So you were set up.
So it was time to rock and roll. It was exactly the right move.
But man, what a culture shock it would have been moving from the big city up here to Lufkin, which would have been nothing probably at the time.
I'll tell you how bad it was. I thought it was so impoverished. I bought a battery, a big 8 battery charger and 16 chargeable batteries. God knows if you could buy batteries up here, wouldn't it be?
Yeah, no kidding.
I had no idea.
Oh, yeah, it would have been.
And
just
man, going primitive. Across the river to get a six pack from Huntington. I was living in Huntington. My
a long
God,
way.
It's a long
yeah,
way.
Yeah, yeah.
Thought this is retarded.
Yeah.
These folks have got to get a grip.
Yeah. Oh, I know. Growing up in Houston, I would have thought the same thing. It would have just been.
But it was. You know, it was the best thing I ever did. And so we moved to East Texas and been here ever since. And I worked at that radio station off and on till '84.
So the music came before the radio.
Music came before the radio.
Okay, and then of course, it was
music,
radio.
Music supported my radio habit.
And we're about out
is
of
exactly,
time here.
That's exactly what happened. And then we did American Classic Country and Tradio and all that in the 90s.
Oh, man,
and,
yeah.
And
there's a long story there.
Lost all that.
From Tradio and American Classic
Lost all
country.
That. And
a lot of years in there.
There was a lot of years in there.
Yeah.
So we're out of time.
It's a big story.
Anyway, we moved on to Blind Like Me and Blind Handy Man, and here we are.
Phil, thank you.
Well, thank you, sir.
It's
been good, and I appreciate you. Thanks for doing it.
One other thing.
What?
Can I ask you one other question?
Sure.
How do you want to be remembered by your friends and your family?
I don't know.
Yes,
I have no
do.
Idea. As a free spirit. As a free spirit, as someone who thought a little out of the box, I just want people to think of Phil Parr as he was a free spirit. He didn't do things conventionally. He thought, it's a cliche, but out of the box. He was inventive. He was.
Very good.
I knew
that was what you would say, but I had to ask the question. Thank you, Don Shaw.
Yeah, Tom, it's been a good show here,
really?
Talking over these old times.
Well, we had an interesting guy to talk to, Don Patterson.
Yeah, it was great.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Known him a long time, and
show number 100.
Happy show number 100 is done, I guess.
Who would have ever thought when Blind Like Me started, you know, and I'm sure say the same thing. It's just, who would have ever thought 100 shows later that Blind Like Me would still
who would have thought 140 Blind Handy Man?
You know, and, of course, next week, Phil will be back, and he'll be sitting in his chair and talking to somebody who's very interesting, just like he is.
Yeah, one more guest.
So I guess for Don Shaw, Don Patterson, Phil Farr, I'm Tom Houston. See you later.